Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question, you may press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Your host of today's call is Leticia Davila. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Trish. Good afternoon. I am Leticia Davila, and I am representing the Clinician Outreach and Communication Activities, COCA, with the Division of Strategic National Stockpile at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I am delighted to welcome you to today's COCA webinar, Management and Prevention of Pediatric Influenza in Healthcare Settings. We are pleased to have with us today Dr. Joseph Breezy, Dr. Hank Bernstein, and Dr. Brent Kasny. They will discuss strategies to improve influenza prevention and control in children and will describe ways to leverage seasonal influenza planning to improve pandemic preparedness. You may participate in today's presentation by audio only or via webinar. The webinar link can be found on our COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Click on COCA calls. The webinar link is located under the call-in number and call passcode. The slides will be available a few days after today's call. At the conclusion of today's session, the participant will be able to discuss strategies to assist clinicians in preparing for the 2014-2015 influenza season, identify approaches to reduce influenza disease burden in children, and describe how to leverage seasonal influenza action plans to address annual flu surge. In compliance with continuing education requirements, CDC, our planners, presenters, and their spouses and partners wish to disclose they have no financial interests or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. Planners have reviewed content to ensure there is no bias. The presentation will not include any discussion of the unlabeled use of a product or products under investigational use. CDC does not accept commercial support. At the end of the presentation, you will have the opportunity to ask the presenters questions. On the phone, dialing star 1 will put you in the queue for questions. You may submit questions through the webinar system at any time during the presentation by selecting the Q&A tab at the top of the webinar screen and typing in your question. Our first presenter, Dr. Breezy, is Chief of the Epidemiology and Prevention Branch in the Influenza Division at CDC. His branch is responsible for conducting influenza surveillance, working to understand influenza disease burden, helping to derive appropriate vaccine and antiviral use policies to prevent seasonal influenza, detecting and preventing avian influenza and pandemic influenza, and providing technical expertise to global public health partners. Dr. Breezy is a pediatrician and is captain in the U.S. Public Health Service. Our second presenter, Dr. Hank Bernstein. He is the associate editor of the Red Book Online and recent member of the Committee on Infectious Diseases of the American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, whose responsibility it is to develop and revise guidelines of the AAP for control of infectious diseases in children. Our final presenter, Dr. Brent Kasny, is a pediatric emergency medicine trained physician and former Utah State Representative for Disaster Preparedness for the state of Utah's chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He is also an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at Baylor College of Medicine, and he serves as a physician liaison for Texas Children's Hospital Emergency Management Committee. Again, the PowerPoint slide set and webinar link are available from our COCA webpage at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. At this time, please welcome Dr. Breezy.
Hey, everybody. This is Joe Breezy, and thanks for having me on the call. I'm going to spend maybe 10 minutes just to set the stage for Brent and Hank to talk about some of the specific recommendations for this year. And what I want to do is spend a few minutes talking about the surveillance systems in the United States and what's happening now with flu and what we're watching with flu, using last year as a sort of a jumping-off point for that. And last, I want to spend a few minutes talking about why flu vaccines are so unique and how we think about changing strains each year and what goes into those decisions and why we think it's a very complex procedure. And so let me start here. Many of you know this, and I apologize if I'm saying simple things, but the way the influenza surveillance systems work in the United States, CDC houses between 8 and 10 different influenza seasons, depending on if you're a lumper or a splitter. And those systems measure a variety of outcomes of influenza, from laboratory positives to mild illness, outpatient illness, hospitalizations, deaths, and novel influenza A development. So a variety of types of parts of flu are surveyed for each week during the year through a variety of systems. And what happens is the data comes into CDC from these 8 to 10 systems, usually each Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday morning of each week. We compile the data, clean it, and look at it, and publish a report called FluView, which this picture shows, every Friday, or usually around 10 o'clock, depending on how down to the wire we are, about 10 to 10:30. This is usually posted on our website and describes what's happening with flu in a very updated and we think, a very comprehensive way. Thinking about these systems, looking at last year's flu season, as you recall, there was last year we thought was a moderate flu season. Here's a slide of what we call the influenza ILI net, which measures clinic-based influenza-like illness over time. And what this system does is measure the proportion positive. So of all the patients you see in your office, what fraction have influenza-like illness? This is a pretty good way to monitor influenza in the country. And what you see is this, a multicolored line slide, is the last six seasons or so. Last season was the one in the red. And I want to say two things about last season based on this slide. First is, it was an early season. It was, in fact, the second early season in a row where we had a December peak. Usually we have about a March peak in influenza disease. And second, if you look at the height of the curve in the red again, you see it was a pretty moderate season, not the worst season we've seen in the last 6 years, but certainly more severe than some. So a moderate season that had an early peak of disease. And this is a slide that shows the last 30 so seasons, when we usually see peaks in the influenza season. And you see that February is the most common month we see, and about 80% of the seasons peak somewhere between January and March. And so to have two seasons in a row with December peaks is relatively unusual. So the next slide is a slide of our laboratory data from last year. And the main point I want to make here is also you see the early peak in December of the laboratory data, which mirrors the disease data. But mostly I want to show that the color is orange. And what that means to us is that it was an influenza A H1 predominant year. This is actually quite unusual. About 90% or 85% of the isolates were A's last year, and most of those were H1 disease. This is the first time we've seen much H1 since the pandemic year of 2009. And if you look at this, you see that only in the last 20 or so years we've only had six of those 21 years where H1 was the dominant virus, and again, only one in the past 5 years. So a relatively unusual last year for that reason as well. Oops, I'm trying to change the slide. Let's see if it works. Yeah, there it goes. And finally, we have a few ways to look at how severe the disease was last year. This is one that's relevant for you all. This is if you die of influenza and you have a lab-confirmed illness in the United States and you're 18 years old or below, it's meant to be a nationally notifiable disease. If you look at the far right side here, we had 107 deaths. It's 107 up top is the true number. 107 deaths reported as of last year. And this is, again, a moderate severe season. We've had more deaths reported in some years and fewer deaths in some years. Notably, that last year, like the previous years, that about 90 or 80% of the kids who died had not been vaccinated that year before. So this is another way to look at the efficacy of influenza vaccine and the need to get all our kids vaccinated. Let me just say a brief word about how well the vaccine worked last year. This is a slide that shows the vaccine effectiveness by age group. And again, if you look at the far right side, you see that overall we had about a 52% effectiveness last year, the flu vaccine. And in kids, if you scan down that right-hand column, you see it was about 50 to 60% for kids. This is about what we normally see each year in the United States, about a 50% to 60 or 70% effectiveness rate of the vaccine. I wanted to make one point, though. Over the last couple of years, there's been a host of studies that have looked at the more severe outcomes and how well the vaccine protects against that. We published a study where the data are summarized in this slide, looking at how well the vaccine protected against ICU admissions among children, and you see that in the 2 years between 2010 and 2012, there was a 74% effectiveness against ICU admissions for influenza. And so while flu does protect 50 to 60% of the time for its office visits, it may well protect against severe disease to a greater extent. And that's something worth communicating to our patients. Finally, and increasingly, we're transforming these data on vaccine effectiveness and vaccine coverage in the U.S. to try to estimate the total annual disease burden averted by influenza vaccine as maybe an easier way to communicate the value of influenza vaccines. We did this. We published a couple of papers this last year. Look at the bottom left box here, and that shows in the 2012-13 year, which is the last year for which we have good data, that influenza vaccination in the United States prevented 3 million cases of influenza, almost 2 million cases of clinic visits, and about 15,000 hospitalizations that otherwise would have occurred. We'll present the data for this last season, hopefully in the next week or two, so you'll have something to talk about with your patients to show the substantial beneficial impact of influenza vaccines. Finally, I'll say while we're monitoring in seasonal influenza, we're still monitoring a variety of other things, including the avian influenzas in China, the swine origin influenzas in the United States, the development, hopefully lack of development of oseltamivir resistance, and the variety of new treatments and universal vaccine developments that are ongoing. There's lots of things happening in flu right now, both in terms of viruses and in terms of treatment and prevention strategies. And so I think the landscape has changed very quickly over the last few years, will continue to change very quickly over the next few years. And let me just finish with a couple of words about strain selection, how we decide whether to change a strain in the vaccine for the annual vaccine or not. If you look at the next slide, there it is, the influenza is unique for a couple of reasons. First, that the virus, the vaccine induces strain-specific immunity, and that requires a multivalent vaccine, either a 3- or 4-valent vaccine, rather than just a single strain. Second, that the vaccine targets are multiple. Not only do we have 3 or 4 seasonal vaccines to protect against, we have the emergence continuously of a variety of pandemic or potentially pandemic strains, all of which deserve and require vaccine preparation or at least vaccine development. So a very robust and very ever-changing and active field. Third is that each subtype and type of flu changes all the time, so we need an annual vaccine that's updated every year to keep up with the changing strains. And finally, all that has to be done every year. So we monitor vaccines year-round. We recommend which strains will go in the vaccine in February. Manufacturers make the vaccine over the ensuing 5 or 6 months. We distribute the vaccine in August and September, October, and do most of our vaccination in the fall. So all in a very tight timeline. Oops, let me skip this slide. Try to skip this slide. There we go. And the way this is done is a variety of laboratories around the world are looking for flu all the time. If you look at this slide in the top left box, there's 136 laboratories in 106 countries around the world that do the surveillance, find the flu positives. They take those data, they send them to WHO every week. They take the samples they get, the flu positives, and send them to 1 of 5 international laboratories, one of which is at CDC in Atlanta. Those laboratories look at the strains. They look at the antigens, the proteins on the surface, the genetic characteristics, the antiviral resistance. They come up with whether they think if the strains are changing or not, and then they develop the vaccines against the strains. tests and send those vaccine candidates to all the manufacturers in the world free of charge for vaccine development. All this is coordinated by the World Health Organization. And so each year, as all the data come into CDC and the other four labs of all the different strains that are circulating, we look at the data and we ask four questions. And this will determine whether the strains are updated or whether they remain the same from year to year. And usually, again, one strain or two strains changes every year. It's fairly uncommon to have all strains stay the same, which has happened in the last year. First is, are there new antigenic variants developing for an H3 or an H1? Are they changing? Second is, are they changing in a way that's concerning? Are they becoming more common? Are they becoming more geographically widespread? Third is, do the current vaccines protect against them? If we vaccinate a ferret, for instance, with the current vaccine, will it protect against the new emerging strains or not? If not, we think we might need to change the strain in the vaccine. And finally, among the new variants, is there one we can make a vaccine from? It often happens, or sometimes happens, that there are new variants, but there's no individual virus that grows well enough in eggs or is a good enough vaccine candidate that we can't change the vaccine. And so not only do we need to know if it's changing, but we have to find the right virus that actually grows well enough in eggs to make a vaccine in large volumes. And again, all this has to be done on a time clock in the fall, make the decision in February, and the vaccines are all made in the next 5 months. And so, in summary, I'll say that there's a bunch of new data to indicate that the vaccines are beneficial to kids, and increasingly there's good data on showing the vaccines are beneficial against severe outcomes in kids, which are most important. Second is that influenza, our communication plan and the influenza division at CDC will increasingly focus on severe disease prevention and the annual substantial impact of influenza vaccines in the country. And third is that all this, the benefits of vaccine, is predicated on being able to make a vaccine each year. And to remind you that the vaccine production is a complex beast, and it's time-sensitive, annually updated, and hopefully each year we make a pretty good prediction on what's going to circulate that following year, and we get good enough effectiveness that a lot of the disease that will occur on our kids. And I'll stop there and turn it over to Hank Bernstein for the rest of the talk.
Great. Thank you, Joe. Great job. And let me try and advance the slides here. No, that didn't work. Can somebody advance the slides?
Yes.
I have lost the slide. Here we go. Got it. Thank you. Sorry for the technical difficulty. So I'm going to talk about the influenza recommendations for 2014-2015. And there are six key messages that I hope to convey. One is that influenza vaccine is needed annually, including this year, even though the strains haven't changed. Everyone who's 6 months of age and older should get the vaccine. As I mentioned and Joe mentioned earlier, the vaccine strains are identical to the ones last year, and which is pretty unusual, that usually there's antigenic changes, but not between last year's vaccine and this year's vaccine. There are both tri- and quadrivalent influenza vaccines available throughout the country, and when readily available, LAIV should be considered for healthy children 2 through 8 years of age. There's a dosing algorithm that's produced by the American Academy of Pediatrics and the CDC, and it's for children 6 months through 8 years, and it does reflect the fact that the vaccine strains have not changed, and egg-allergic children should be vaccinated. As you can see in this slide, influenza is a common and serious public health problem, contributing significantly to patient morbidity and mortality, and it creates a huge financial burden on our healthcare systems. You can see the notable impact of influenza each year in comparison with other vaccine-preventable diseases. Influenza spread from person to person quite easily and primarily by respiratory droplets created by coughing and sneezing. Contact with those droplets that are contaminating surfaces is another probable mode of transmission. During community outbreaks of influenza, the highest attack rates occur amongst school-age children. Secondary spread to adults and other children within a family is quite common, as we're all aware. From this slide, you can see that influenza imposes a heavy disease burden on our society in the U.S. in every year. Because it's so highly contagious, acute respiratory disease, influenza is responsible for an average of 50 to 60 million infections annually, which result in 25 million healthcare visits, hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations, and thousands of deaths of all ages. In pediatrics, as you heard, it was only 107, but there many of them are preventable by vaccine. This is a slide that you saw from Joe as well, and I'll only comment that in the 2013-2014 season, the weekly percentage of outpatient visits for influenza-like illness to outpatient network facilities exceeded the national baseline of 2% for 14 weeks. So it really was a moderate season, and it was an early peak. Children with certain medical conditions are at higher risk of complications. And as you can see here, asthma is number one, and neurologic disorders are number two. Among children hospitalized with laboratory-confirmed influenza, almost half, 43%, were perfectly healthy and did not have any underlying medical condition. So it's important for us to not just earmark those at higher risk, but all people 6 months of age and older should be getting the vaccine. This slide also Joe showed, and again, there were 103 deaths, pediatric deaths, and back with during the pandemic, there were 348 deaths. Prior to the pandemic, it was usually under 100. So it is very unpredictable, and many of these, this morbidity and mortality is preventable by vaccine. Last year, as you also heard, that influenza A, the pandemic H1N1, was the most common strain. Compared with the 2012-2013 season, there were less outpatient visits, less hospitalizations, and less deaths. This highlights that both trivalent and quadrivalent vaccines will be available in the 2014-2015 influenza season. The quadrivalent vaccines contain the same three strains as the trivalent vaccine, but they add an additional B strain, which is the opposite lineage. There are two lineages of B, and then the quadrivalent has both of those B lineages. And again, all the strains are unchanged from those included in last year's vaccine. All people 6 months of age and older should get the flu vaccine. Because the circulating flu viruses often change from year to year, annual vaccination against the flu is necessary, even when the vaccine strains have not changed. This is the number of seasonal influenza doses for children 6 months through 8 years of age. Infants younger than 6 months of age are too young to be immunized with influenza vaccine, and children 9 years of age and older need only one dose. It's those children 6 months through 8 years where we need to determine how many doses they need each year. And the number of doses needed depends upon the patient's flu vaccine history and their age. This dosing algorithm reflects that the virus strains in the vaccine have not changed from last year. So number of children who may have routinely needed two vaccine doses. If the vaccine strains had changed, only will need one dose this season. There are special populations that we need to reach. Each year, seasonal flu places a large burden on children, and they commonly need medical care because of influenza, especially those children under 5 years of age. Each year, an average of 20,000 children under the age of five are hospitalized because of influenza complications. Although immunization is the best way to prevent outbreaks, vaccination rates among healthcare personnel remain well below the expected targets. And influenza vaccination coverage among healthcare personnel is important for patient safety. We know that mandatory annual influenza immunization has been recommended by the AAP and has been implemented successfully at a number of pediatric institutions. Annual seasonal influenza vaccine is especially important for household members and out-of-home caregivers of children and adolescents at high risk of complications of influenza, and then again all children, including healthy ones, under the age of five, and especially infants under the age of 6 months, because they cannot get immunized themselves. And the fourth group on this slide are pregnant women. We know that pregnant women are at increased risk for hospitalization and death from influenza, and it has been found and documented that maternal vaccination during pregnancy, at any time during pregnancy, can protect newborns against influenza during their first few months of life. This slide is talking about LAIV, which is given intranasal, versus the inactivated influenza vaccine given by injection. And using the GRADE framework, the CDC Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices systematically reviewed the evidence pertaining to the efficacy of LAIV and IIV for healthy children. It concluded that there seemed to be an increased relative efficacy of LAIV as compared with IIV against laboratory-confirmed influenza amongst younger children up through 6 years of age. Therefore, LAIV should be considered for healthy children 2 through 8 years of age who have no contraindications or precautions to the intranasal vaccine. However, if LAIV is not available at that particular visit, IIV should be used. Vaccination should never be delayed in order to obtain LAIV down the road. We know that patients tend not to come back. They go unimmunized or are eligible for it, but end up getting influenza at an early age. GRADE is that systematic review of the literature. It takes into account the quality of the evidence, strength of recommendations, health impact, and multiple other elements. This is one of the studies that supported the GRADE analysis, and this is a study of about 8,000 children. The top line are those children that received inactivated vaccine. The bottom line in red is those that received the live attenuated vaccine, and you can see that the proportion of children with influenza who got inactivated vaccine was 8.5% versus around 4 to 4.5% for those that received live attenuated influenza vaccine. This is another study that again suggests the same finding, that it appears that LAIV is more efficacious, especially into through 8 years of age. In this study, there were 53% fewer cases of influenza in those that received LAIV in comparison to IIV. This slide highlights for us that the age-specific influenza vaccine coverage really does vary by age, but you can see that children 2 through 8 years of age in particular have low rates of vaccine coverage and would benefit and have lots of notable room for improvement. Full vaccine coverage, which is two doses, is...
I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, as the years have gone on...
Excuse me, speakers,
hello?
Please mute your phones. Go ahead, Dr. Bernstein.
Thank you. So as you can see from full coverage data, there's notable room for improvement. And this next slide gives us the vaccine coverage, and although the right-hand side of the slide for the 2013-2014, the data was literally just released this week, and it has improved. It moved from 57% up to 59%. For children 6 months through 18 years. So we're making headway, but there is still lots of room for improvement. This slide is intended to highlight that as soon as the vaccine is available, pediatricians and vaccine administrators should start giving the vaccine as soon as possible and offer it throughout the season. Protective immune responses persist during the influenza season, and as we know, influenza can actually have more than one peak of activity in any particular geographic area and may extend, as you saw from the earlier slides that Joe presented, can extend throughout and well into March, April, and May. These are ideas in order to make vaccine easily accessible to families. We should email or text or use patient portals, create influenza clinics, extend our office hours during peak vaccination periods, administer it during well as well as sick visits if at all possible, consider immunizing parents and adult caregivers and siblings of children, and work with other institutions or alternate care sites in order to make vaccine available. They're going to be anticipated to be close to 165 million doses available around the country this year from the manufacturers. Recent data has shown that IIV administered as a single age-appropriate dose is well tolerated by nearly all recipients who have egg allergy. So this slide that gives an approach to children with presumed egg allergy is something that we should be aware of, but understand that egg allergy is not a contraindication for giving influenza vaccine. We also know that cocooning is a vaccination strategy that aims to reduce infection in children by immunizing those around the children. If the people that are around the children, the close contacts of children, are protected by the vaccine, then they're less likely to get influenza, and they're less likely then to expose their children. This concept of cocooning is particularly important to help infants under 6 months of age because they're too young to be immunized with influenza vaccine. According to the data from the 2013-2014 season, the most common place for vaccinating adults and children was the doctor's office. So you can see two-thirds of all children were vaccinated in the doctor's office, and about a third of adults were vaccinated there. Adults and children have used other alternate venues like pharmacies or stores or workplaces, and even some schools have offered influenza vaccine. This is just intended to remind us that antivirals are very important in the control of influenza, and when used for treatment, antivirals can lessen the symptoms and shorten the duration of the flu by 1 to 2 days. Neuraminidase inhibitors, specifically oseltamivir, Tamiflu, or zanamivir, Relenza, are used for treatment or prophylaxis. This slide shows that both of these neuraminidase, only oseltamivir, because Relenza is inhaled. Oseltamivir can be given to infants under a year of age, right down to birth. And this includes both term and preterm infants, The dose varies based upon their postmenstrual age. So in conclusion, I just want to remind everyone that everyone 6 months of age and older needs vaccine. The strains have not changed. Tri and quadrivalent vaccines are available this season. When available in your office, LAIV should be considered for healthy children 2 through 8 years of age. There is a dosing algorithm to be sure that children 6 months through 8 years are adequately primed. And egg allergy is nothing that we should really be concerned about anymore. All those children should also receive the vaccine, or essentially all of them. Thanks, and I'll pass the presentation over to Brent Kasny.
Hi, thank you guys. Thank you for having me on the call. I just am going to try and rush through some of this just because I want us to end on time at 45 minutes past the hour so that we have plenty of time for questions. I do have a lot of slides, but I'm going to try and get through it here. As somebody that's emergency department based, I have a little bit of a different view on things, but I think that I've got some strategies that will hopefully be helpful for the general pediatrician, the physician in the community hospital, as well as those in the tertiary and quaternary pediatric facilities. I think, you know, why should we care about this issue in general? I think we wouldn't be on this call if we didn't know the answer to this question, but, you know, H1N1, looking at some of the numbers then, are nothing new or crazy, but, you know, disproportionate number of children were affected with almost three quarters of the hospitalizations, cases being in children age 0 to 24, and over half of hospitalizations affecting children. And we also know that our hospitals in the United States tend to not be specifically focused on pediatric preparedness. A CDC survey in 2008 showing that only about a third of hospitals had guidelines for increasing pediatric surge capacity. And while hospitals don't seem to be particularly prepared for this, we do know that the community at large does think that it's an important thing. If you look at the Marist College of Institute of Public Opinion poll that they conducted for the AAP in October of 2010, you saw that a majority of people surveyed thought that not only should there be, you know, some consideration given to preparedness for children, but it really should be a higher priority for children's preparedness over the needs of adults. So in Texas, we see a lot of hurricanes, especially here in Houston, and so we kind of tend to view things in kind of analogies related to the storm, the coming storm. And I think, you know, you'll hear me kind of talk in these analogies throughout the rest of my talk, but I think what's really important is to kind of have that eye on preparedness prior to the arrival of the surge, so kind of preparing for the storm before it's coming. And some really, you know, starting at the institution, and while I'm talking about a hospital, this could apply to a pediatric office or what have you, I think a key that we've heard over and over again is the importance of vaccination. And I think, in particular, the importance of vaccination among healthcare workers could be improved upon. When you look at some of the numbers, only about two-thirds of healthcare workers have received an influenza vaccine, despite some mandating at various institutions. There are definitely some tried-and-true strategies for improving vaccination rates, and these include improving education for healthcare workers, as well as just making it easier for them to access these vaccines. So giving it to them in the workplace, in the unit, not making them go to employee health, et cetera, to receive these. In addition, working with healthcare workers who refuse to vaccinate, putting them in lower-risk areas of work, making them wear a mask, et cetera, maybe some things that kind of discourage them from not wanting to get that vaccine. I think another thing that's important to look at and focus on is the fact that you really should anticipate about 20% absenteeism should there be a significant flu event. You know, given individuals getting sick and or having to care for children of theirs at home that are sick, really beefing up your staffing prior to a potential flu surge can really be helpful in the long run. In addition to just protecting your healthcare workers through, you know, employing good hand hygiene product initiatives, as well as having the appropriate PPE available for them. Now, it's not just about preparing the institution, but obviously preparing those at risk. And Dr. Bernstein and Dr. Breezy have touched a bit on this, but I think, you know, it's really important to look at these at-risk patients and recognize that as an emergency department physician, whether it be in a pediatric facility and or a community hospital, you're really touching these patients quite a bit. They're coming into your ER for asthma exacerbations, fever, et cetera. And I think talking to them when they have these visits can be very helpful in kind of encouraging them to get the vaccine if they haven't already gotten it, and hopefully improving some of these vaccination rates among these at-risk patients. And then from the emergency department standpoint, I think it's also important to look at partnering with our primary care partner physicians out there in the community, identifying networks of primary care physicians, whether they be within your home hospital network and or outside of that, and really showing yourself as an institution to be kind of an institution that vets some of this information that's being passed down from the CDC and AAP, and opening two-way communication among yourselves as well as these primary care physicians to share information regarding strategies for testing, treating, and when to refer to the emergency department. And I can say firsthand as a physician that works in the emergency department, it's extremely important for parents to have kind of the appropriate expectations for their emergency department visit. If it is a patient that you decide to refer to the emergency department, this can improve, I think, their experience as well as the timeliness of their visit, allowing that tertiary, quaternary care center to see more patients and kind of offload some of the burden. In addition to preparing our kind of primary care partners, I think creating relationships with outside hospitals is also beneficial, and you can work on that through kind of hopefully the creation of some coalitions in your region. I think it's mostly about sharing that similar information you'd be sharing with the primary care physicians, but also about just finding a pediatric champion at each of these facilities. So finding somebody, whether it's a nurse manager or an emergency department physician, or just one of the hospitalists that works there, that really has taken it upon, you know, kind of as they're kind of carrying the mantle as the pediatric champion for that facility, allowing you somebody to communicate directly with that can then disseminate that information to the rest of their staff. And I think this coalition building goes beyond seasonal flu surge, but I do think that the annual nature to flu surge really provides a good way to test these relationships, to work on these avenues of communication and improve them. Because they can provide beneficial in multiple different scenarios, whether or not it be mass casualty, pandemic, et cetera. But I think this annual nature really helps build this nice relationship. So we've talked a little bit about things that you can do before the surge occurs, but how do you know when the surge is coming? And I think this is something that obviously the CDC does a very good job of working towards, as we've seen in Dr. Breezy's presentation. And I think they provide kind of the big view, the big picture view, and I think their flu site can provide you with kind of the National Weather Service version of flu surge and when to expect that impending surge. And this website can be very helpful for that. But I think what are some things that you can do in your region a little bit more close to home to try and figure out when that surge is going to come? I think some things that you can do, you know, I like to think about these our community hospitals in our region as well as our primary care physician providers and partners as kind of buoys out in the water. As that storm approaches, you know, they're going to be the first people to see some of this action. And something that we're working on at Texas Children's this year is actually trying to surveil flu tests that are being sent by primary care physicians within our network of pediatricians, as well as prescriptions of oseltamivir, to see if we're getting kind of an increase in the rate of those tests being sent and prescriptions being sent off to potentially identify when that surge might occur. In the hospital, random surveillance testing as flu season approaches can be very helpful in identifying when we're going to see the flu hit us in a major way, and monitoring the percentage of positive tests in our lab can be very helpful as well. Some other things that you can do is just in a hospital level, look at overcrowding in your emergency department. We've utilized the NEDOX system to a bit, which is an emergency department overcrowding scale that can really show you in real time when you're getting to a point where things are getting too crowded for you to deal with and need some additional help. And so what does that additional help look like? And I think when looking at surge response, there's kind of two things that are really important, making something that's going to be scalable as well as sustainable. And we're going to talk kind of small to large with regards to how to effectively initiate some action plans that can help you during the course of a flu season. I think on the small end of things is utilizing your available resources that you have day-to-day, but in a very different way. And the way that you can do that is restructuring your current resources to allow for improved efficiency and patient throughput. Some things that have been done in the past are triage-based screening tools for patients with ILI, separate waiting rooms, as well as streamlined charting. I think providing a checkbox-type paper chart or electronic tablet-based charting tool for patients with ILI can really improve throughput and increase efficiency of that provider that's seeing a large number of patients very quickly. And this has been shown to work in the past. In addition, I know that my former partners and colleagues at the University of Utah utilize discharge video reviewing flu basics. And when you think about it, the 3 to 5 minutes that an emergency department physician spends with a family reviewing the basics of the flu as they go about their discharge, if you could cut that out completely, allow them to watch a video and then answer questions, that could save a tremendous amount of time over the course of an entire shift. So that's just using the things that you have at your disposal every day, but kind of restructuring them to improve throughput. Now, obviously, you get to a point where you need some extra help. And something that we've done here at Texas Children's, and that's been done at some other facilities as well with varying degrees of success, is having surge staffing. So having the presence of an additional physician in the emergency department that's on call, as well as nurses that are on call, because you need both to really effectively see patients in a timely manner, and have some hospital-based metrics that identify when you should trigger that person to come in and start helping see patients. Now, obviously, that's an additional resource, but we've seen at Texas Children's that that has improved significantly the number of our patients leaving without being seen, and it's something that the administration has really bought into because they see the number of patients that are leaving, and then after the implementation of this program, they see that those patients are not leaving without being seen, and that's something that they really want to improve upon. Again, going back to these coalitions that I've discussed earlier, I think it really needs to you really need to focus on these in these surge type situations. This is a two-way street. So hopefully, if you know if there were to be some type of pandemic or kind of a harsh flu season, you're working with these outside facilities, providing them with the expertise that you have as a pediatric center. But at the same time, they should really be working trying to buffer that pediatric tertiary or quaternary care facility from seeing these large numbers of worried well and non-critical patients. And I think that kind of relationship and that back and forth is very important to build, hopefully building that prior to flu season so that you've got some of these kind of networks as well as the infrastructure for that network in place. And then we get to kind of the big response when things are really going crazy in the emergency department. You need a vast number of resources. And here we've used, and similar things have been studied at other institutions, we refer to it as our mobile pediatric emergency response team, which we used post-Katrina in the Reliant Stadium shelter and also during H1N1. For H1N1, that looked, and it can look like a variety of different things, but for H1N1 it looked like a kind of mobile emergency department that was put up in a parking lot, basically. And so it's a creation of an additional resource, a resource that you don't usually have in your day-to-day. It requires a mobilization of a lot of resources. But it has been shown to work as far as improving throughput of patients, and it's also been shown to be something that families don't mind doing. So families and caregivers both seem to be amenable to care in this non-traditional setting as long as they're being seen and helped out in their time of need. So what are some available resources out there to both the general pediatrician as well as the hospital-based doc in the emergency department who's interested in improving the response at their facility? I think one of these things is put out by the AAP, which is a terrific resource, the Pediatric Preparedness Resource Kit. It was a product developed out of the Enhancing Pediatric Partnerships to Promote Pandemic Preparedness meeting in 2011. I challenge you to say that five times quickly. There's a lot of P's there. But there's really a key emphasis placed on improving communication and information flow, which I think we've touched on previously in this talk, as well as identifying those pediatric experts. I think experts is maybe the wrong word. I think it's that pediatric champion in every community that you can rely on. And then just prioritizing pediatric preparedness and improvement in general, as we know that it needs to be improved upon in our country. And it's available online as a PDF. Here's a picture of the cover page of it. And you can reach it via going to the AAP's website and looking at their Children in Disaster site. And I think it's a terrific resource. In addition, there was recently a three-day workshop that was presented by the CDC. Multiple children's hospitals applied to participate in this workshop, and Primary Children's Medical Center in the University of Utah was selected. They did a three-day workshop with the CDC and Primary Children's looking at ways to improve response and surge planning. And I think there was a significant focus during that talk on coalition building, but there's a lot more to come from them down the road. I think they've got a lot of interesting stuff that came out of that three-day workshop that will be on the horizon, so keep an eye out for that. So I think in summary, you know, there are some available resources out there already for the emergency department and or general pediatrician doc to look at. I think it's mostly about preparing the institution, looking at ways to know when the surge is coming, and then obviously keying in on scalable and sustainable methods to deal with the surge when it occurs. So thank you very much for your time, and I guess now I'll pass it over to Leticia.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Breezy, Dr. Bernstein, and Dr. Kasny for providing our COCA audience with such a wealth of information. We will now open up the lines for the Q&A answer session. And also remember, you can submit questions through the webinar system. Operator?
Thank you. At this time, we will begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, please press star 1 and record your first and last name. If you wish to withdraw your question, please press star 2. One moment, please, for your first question. We have no questions on the phone at this time.
Okay, we do have some that have come through the webinar system. The first one is, the flu vaccine supply to our office has been delayed. What do we need to know about the situation overall at this time?
This is Joe Brzee. I can take a crack at that if you want me to. I don't know the true answer to the question. I can relate that, in fact, we should have plenty of supply this year. We're expected to have a plenty of supply this year, the flu vaccine, as Hank had said earlier. And so talk to the place that you ordered it from to see what the delay is about. But we think that there should be all the vaccine should be available that you ordered well ahead of the influenza season this year. Again, if you look at the right side of my slides, we're not seeing much influenza circulation right now, so it looks like we have a few more weeks now before we start seeing an uptick in influenza disease, hopefully. So hopefully plenty of time still left to vaccinate, even if your supply is delayed.
Thank you. We do have another one that has come in. It says, could you suggest some YouTube videos or other short videos for education of families?
Mm. So I can speak on that since I did mention some. I don't know of any. Sorry, this is Brent Kasny. I don't know of any YouTube videos that might be out there. Please, Dr. Brzee and Dr. Bernstein, chime in if you know of any. I know that the University of Utah produced their own video and utilized that in their emergency department quite effectively. But I don't know of any YouTube videos that might be helpful. Does anybody
you
else
might,
have, a call? Have any ideas?
Yeah, this is Hank. You might also look at PreventChildhoodInfluenza.org or FamiliesFightingFlu.org. I don't know that they're specific to, they have specific YouTube videos per se, but there's a wealth of information about influenza for families on both of those websites, and they're wonderful, and the information is top-notch. So I would encourage, I know there's some videos on the PreventChildhoodInfluenza.org website, which is the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases.
And finally, this is Joe. There's also some video clips available on the CDC website. If you go to the CDC Influenza website, you should be able to find those fairly easily, and they relate to vaccine and antiviral recommendations and influenza vaccines.
Thank you. The next question is, what populations of patients are recommended to receive the quadrivalent over the trivalent vaccine?
Thank you, Anna.
Yeah, so currently, this is Hank. So currently, the American Academy of Pediatrics there and the CDC, there's no preference for one over the other. Logistically, it would make sense that being protected against four vaccine strains, both lineages of influenza B, would be a preference over the trivalent, but we don't have a full analysis of the use of quadrivalent, which is being studied by the CDC and data being gathered. We don't have that information, and we also know that the manufacturers have not totally shifted to producing only quadrivalent. So the recommendation in general is immunize as many children as you can with influenza vaccine, either tri or quadrivalent. If quadrivalent is available, certainly that might be a choice. I should mention that the intranasal vaccine, the live attenuated influenza vaccine, comes only as quadrivalent.
Thank you. The next question is, how would you best explain to a patient who asks, if I received my flu vaccine last year and the strain hasn't changed this year, why do I need to receive a vaccination this year?
I can take an early crack at this, and then maybe Joe wants to chime in. That's a common question that people ask about vaccines in general, and especially flu vaccine. The reason is, first of all, we know that the vaccine is not vaccine effectiveness is not 100%. We also know that the protection that all of us develops, that there's a concept of waning immunity, and that over time, the vaccine immunity in a particular individual may diminish or by as much as 50% over 6 to 8 months. And so getting the vaccine again the following year, even though the vaccine strains haven't changed, will boost that protection and ensure that there's a better protection for that individual in the population at large. So it really is important knowing that the concept of waning immunity does happen over time.
Yeah, nothing to add for me, Hank. That's exactly what I would have said.
Perfect. The next question is, a frequent question I get is, why do we start to give the vaccine in September if the flu is worse in February and March? What is the length of time the vaccine is effective?
Yeah, this is Joe. I'm happy to take that. That's a great question. And the reason we give vaccines starting really in August, but a lot in September and October, is because we know each year flu is going to circulate sometime in the fall and winter, but we don't exactly know when it's going to start. And so we want to get the vaccine ahead of the vaccine of the influenza season, far enough ahead to where we develop enough immunity. Remember, it takes about 2 weeks after you get the vaccine to develop full immunity in most kids. And so we want to make sure we have time ahead of the season, ahead of the risk period, to get the vaccine in. And while the vaccine antibodies do wane over time, vaccinating children who are generally immunologically pretty robust, even a few months before the circulation of the influenza vaccine, they should have plenty of immunity during the influenza circulation period well into April and May. And so September, August, October vaccination, certainly good timing because you get ahead of the season and not too early to where you'd worry about waning immunity in this population.
Operator, we can take 2 questions from the phone lines.
Thank you. You have 1 question in queue right now, and it's from Aaron Colvis. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Actually, it's Karen. Thank you. I just had a follow-up question. The ACIP also just changed the LAIV use recommendation for immunocompetent children with chronic disease. So those with asthma, those with diabetes, those with seizures can all receive LAIV. It's no longer a contraindication but a precaution, and I believe their statement is that providers should determine if it's okay to use. A question that I had is that because of the ACIP guidelines, they stated their preference for LAIV use in 2 through 8 year olds in healthy children. As I understand it, it can be used in 2 through 8 year olds who are immunocompetent, even if they have asthma or another chronic illness, because that is now just a precaution. Am I correct with my interpretation? Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take that one.
Sure. I think that your thinking is correct, that there is a point. The ACIP recommendation has pointed out that in fact, children with chronic medical conditions, whether or not to use LAIV for those children is not a contraindication, but actually a precaution. But the ACIP and the AAP specifically did not intend to make the recommendation that LAIV should be used for children with chronic medical conditions this year. There really is not enough data, especially for children who have chronic respiratory problems, and obviously influenza causes respiratory disease. So the recommendation really is for LAIV for children 2 through 8 years of age who are healthy, not those with chronic medical conditions. A precaution, by definition, is such that if the provider feels that the benefit of using a product or vaccine product or otherwise far outweighs the benefit of not giving it, then certainly that decision can be made by the provider. But the recommendation is for LAIV to be used only in healthy children 2 through 8 years of age.
Thank you.
Operator, we'll take one more from the phone if there is one.
Yes, there is one. Just a moment. The next question comes from Asa Carolla. Go ahead, your line's open.
Yes, hello. Two questions. Why egg allergies are no longer a contraindication? And number two, we're seeing a surge of the enterovirus, and I find that families with children in the hospital are very poorly compliant with precautions. And I thought when the flu season coming, are the of course it's a droplet, but how important do you feel gowns are in addition to the masks and good hand hygiene? Thank you.
I'll start with the egg allergy. The data to date really suggests that people with egg allergy, it's a safe product to be able to be used, the influenza vaccine, in virtually all children with egg allergy. At the moment, our recommendation is to consider whether or not someone who has had anaphylaxis, a serious allergic reaction associated with egg, should receive the vaccine. And most of our allergy colleagues suggest to us that even those individuals can receive the vaccine. I should say that we're talking about the inactivated vaccine by injection. LAIV is under study but has not been fully studied in giving it to children who are presumed to be egg allergic. And then the enterovirus D68 issue, I think, is continuing to sort itself out thanks to the CDC, which has provided lots of information. Your recommendations as far as trying to decrease transmission and droplet and standard precautions is very appropriate and should be emphasized, just as we do every year with influenza. And certainly in the outpatient setting, we're going to see lots of children coming in with ILI and needing to try to decrease the transmission as best we can. I don't know, Joe, if you wanted to add to that.
No, not a bit. I think that, and just to say that on the AAP main website and the CDC main webpage, if you go to cdc.gov or aap.org, you'll see links to information about the new enterovirus as well.
Thank you. We have one final quick question. We are also having a delay with flu vaccine. However, I've been able to obtain both LAIV and IIV for my family practice office. We have been directed to not administer the vaccines until October 1st this year. Usual go date is September 1st. Is there any CDC recommendation or information that would support this delay?
No. Our recommendations generally are the ACIP recommendations, and AAP is to administer the vaccines when they become available. And again, we want to make sure we get the vaccines in at the first opportunity to reach a kid. We don't want to miss those opportunities lest kids remain unvaccinated when flu starts to circulate. So if you have vaccine and you have kids who want the vaccine, it's a good time to go ahead and start.
Thank you. On behalf of COCA, I would like to thank everyone for joining us today, with a special thank you to Dr. Breezy, Dr. Bernstein, and Dr. Kasny. We invite you to communicate to our presenters after the webinar. If you have additional questions for today's presenters, please email us at coca@cdc.gov. Put September 18th COCA call in the subject line of your email, and we will ensure that your question is forwarded to the presenters for a response. Again, that email address is coca@cdc.gov. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to our COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA within the next few days. Free continuing education is available for this call. Those who participated in today's COCA conference call and would like to receive continuing education should complete the online evaluation by October 19, 2014, using course code WC2286SC. For those who will complete the online evaluation between October 20, 2014 and August 17, 2015, use course code WD2286SC. All continuing education credits and contact hours for COCA conference calls are issued online through TCE Online, the CDC Training and Continuing Education Online System at www.cdc.gov/TCE Online. To receive information on upcoming COCA calls, subscribe to COCA by sending an email to coca@cdc.gov and write subscribe in the subject line. Also, CDC launched a Facebook page for health partners. Like our page at facebook.com/CDC Health Partners Outreach to receive COCA updates. Thank you again for being a part of today's COCA webinar. Have a great day.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference. Participants, you may disconnect at this time.